As Act 250 overhaul takes shape, some question whether it strikes the right balance. Plus, new federal rules could impact farm workers in Vermont, and a state policing panel abandons plans to impose more consistent rules for high-speed chases. All that and more ahead on Vermont This Week.
From the Vermont Public Studio in Winooski, this is Vermont This Week. Made possible in part by the Lintelak Foundation and Milm Travel. Here's moderator Mitch Wertlieb.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Friday, February 13th. And with us on the panel today, we have Carly Berlin from Vermont Public and VT Digger, Derek Brower from Vermont Public, and Austin Gaffney from VT Digger. Thanks all to you so much for being here today. And Carly Berlin, I want to start with you because we're going to get into Act 250, which, you know, can be a little difficult to explain, but it's really super important. It deals with housing and changing rules. This is starting to come into focus now after kind of a two-year overhaul effort. Take us back a little bit and then to where we are today.
That's right, Mitch. So in 2024, there was this bill that reformed how Act 250, the Vermont's statewide land use review law, works. The way Act 250 had worked in the past was that it would get triggered based on broadly how large a development was. Yep. What this reform effort did 2 years ago was say, let's trigger the law based on where development is happening. So a new statewide land use map is currently getting drafted. We have drafts of it right now, to be clear. It's not finalized yet. Mm. So we're starting to get insight into where there are going to be exemptions for housing from Act 250 and where there are going to be increased conservation rules.
So there are three tiers, as I understand it, of areas of interest that folks are looking at here. Can you briefly describe what those tiers are going to entail?
Exactly. So tier one is where we're going to have exemptions for housing. And there are actually even two layers of tiers within tier one. This is all
subsets
very weedy,
tiers,
Mitch.
Yeah.
Some areas, you know, larger downtowns will have full exemptions for Act 250 once going through an application process. Other, you know, think village centers will have exemptions up to 50 units of housing. Then I'm going to jump to tier three.
Great.
Tier three is where we're going to see those increased conservation rules. So where the barrier to get into Act 250 is lower, where we want to be protecting important natural resources. Tier two is everything in between. So when
That's
you think about
lot,
it,
though.
It is a lot. It is a lot. And these tier one and tier three areas ultimately are going to be fairly small areas of land, though we're starting to see where they're going to be. Tier two is everything else. And in those areas, generally, Act 250 is going to work as it does now, though there are some new rules based around if you want to build a new private road over a certain length, that would get you into Act 250.
Okay, let's draft off that a little bit, roads. I know that Governor Phil Scott was making some mention of this. He was using an example of his own driveway, he said, which was 800 feet long. And his point was, look, I've got this 800-foot piece of pavement here, but it's not affecting wildlife where I live. He sees all sorts of animals and stuff going around there. What's the point the governor's trying to make there?
Exactly. So the governor wants to repeal this road rule that would kick in if you want to build a private road over 800 feet. The idea behind this rule is to prevent the fragmentation of forests, to keep building closer to the roads. When I asked the governor about wanting to repeal this a couple weeks ago, he said, I see all this wildlife crossing my road. I don't see the point of what this is trying to do.
So, you know, again, the devil's in the details here. And as you say, these are draft maps right now. Nothing is set in stone. But what are some of the concerns already that you're hearing from people who say, hey, wait a minute, maybe pump the brakes a little bit on some of this Act 250 change?
Exactly. I'm hearing a lot of criticism that, you know, this reform effort was framed as this grand bargain between increasing housing and boosting environmental conservation rules, right? I'm hearing this concern that in the reform effort, as it's taking shape, we're skewing more towards the conservation piece and not enough towards the housing piece. Hmm. You know, part of that is just how these maps are taking shape so far. I'm hearing criticism that those tier three boosted conservation areas are too extensive. Hmm. There are some towns writing into the state saying this is really going to hamper where we want to be building housing locally to have this new layer of state level review. On the other hand, on the tier, those tier one areas we talked about, We're seeing some municipalities, especially in, you know, Chittenden County, our population center in Vermont, who have not opted in to getting some of these housing exemptions, who have at least signaled at this stage that they want to keep Act 250, you know, the way it works now as another layer of review for development. So there are a lot of levers here, and we're hearing, you know, the governor, like we talked about, and also rural lawmakers in particular saying, let's pump the brakes on this process. Let's bump these timelines out for some of these things like the road rule and like these tier three increased conservation areas to just give more time for this mapping to play out and get some feedback.
What is the next step then for the draft maps?
It depends on which map we're talking about. So on the tier one level, regional planning commissions are drafting those maps with a lot of input from municipalities. The state then reviews those and approves them. That's going to be happening throughout the course of this year. The tier three maps are being drafted by the state, and we're expecting to see a new draft map of that, you know, any day now, really, this month.
Wow. I appreciate you explaining this in a way that I can understand it, because it really can be very complex. One thing that does seem promising, Carly, is this new catalog I'm hearing about that is about pre-vetted home designs. What is that designed to do?
So the state has started this new program. It's called 802 Homes. And the idea of it is to basically revive the old Sears catalog idea, right, from a century ago, where you would get a mail order blueprint for a house, you'd get all your parts shipped and build it. This is going to work a little differently, but the vision is that we'd have this set of 10 home designs that are pre-approved, and then you would get a fast track through local zoning if you build one of these. The stage this is at now, there are three municipalities who are piloting this project with the state, so they're doing these review workshops of the designs as they're drafted now, and then they're going to work with the state to figure out how this kind of streamlined local zoning approach could work. Those are Hartford, Essex Junction, and Manchester. So we're kind of in the middle of that process now. I went to one of these workshops last weekend. But the state, the governor's administration really wants to expand this to the entire state.
But the pre-approved, you said, who approves the pre-approved rules?
Yeah, no, exactly. So the idea is that the municipality would have some buy-in at the local zoning level. That would be, you know, Division of Fire Safety approval kind of happening at the state level ahead of time, too. So that's the idea here.
Okay. We're going to keep a close eye on that, because that could be promising. Again, there's three towns you said that are piloting this.
Exactly.
Okay, great. Thank you, Carly. Austin Gaffney, I want to move on to you here. Interesting new federal rules could really impact farm workers in Vermont and farmers as well. Can you explain what these new rules entail, why farmers in Vermont may be interested but also may be a bit wary?
Yeah, exactly. So there are new farm worker rules that have been set out by the federal government, and they're state by state. So when you look at Vermont, it looks like Vermont is cutting the hourly wage for workers by more than $4 in some cases, and then in other cases, actually increasing the wage slightly. So there's creating a wide berth that farmers have to work with when they pay their employees. These employees are not just farm workers in Vermont, but farm workers who come on a specialized federal visa for up to 10 months at a time. Most of them are from Jamaica, Mexico, Guatemala, and they're folks that have been coming to Vermont and to the U.S. for decades that farmers really depend on for their workforce.
Yeah, in reading your article, I was really taken that a lot of farmers are saying, you know, I could pay these workers less because of this new federal law, but a lot of ways I don't want to because it could hurt morale. It could maybe even prevent them from working my farm, right?
Yeah, exactly. So again, farmers have been depending on these folks for decades, and they told me that, you know, without these workers coming over, they wouldn't be able to have their farms anymore. And this is anything from like a turkey farm to a maple syrup operation. So it's really quite a breadth. And basically, they are now paying at least 70%, according to the state labor department, either at the wage of last year or above the wage of last year, instead of falling in line with these cut federal wages. So they are trying to maintain their workforce by actually paying more than they have to.
There's a housing component to this, too, as well. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there is a wage deduction of $1.61 per hour for folks to live on employer housing. In the past, so through since 1986 of this program, housing has been provided at no cost. So it's free to these employees who virtually all of them require housing. But now they could potentially see this wage deduction from what they used to make in the past.
And you say that at least 70% of farmers have sort of opted to keep things stable or even increase wages a little bit, but that other 30%, they may be taking advantage of this, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's according to very recent numbers by the State Labor Department. These visas come through in seasonally, so we haven't even seen all the visa listings that we will for the year yet. So this is very like small numbers so far. But yeah, there is a potentially 30% of farm workers who will be returning to the state of Vermont at a cut wage from what they were paid prior.
This is all, of course, complicated, too, by the immigration question, which we're not getting into in this particular story, but we'll be talking about a little bit later in the show. Thanks for that update, Austin. I appreciate that. Derek Brower, let me turn to you now. We have been hearing for so long now about Vermont's aging population. Now it turns out we don't have just that problem, but the population is declining in Vermont. What kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Yeah, we had the steepest decline of any state in the country last year. That's according to U.S. Census estimates. These are one-year estimates. You know, we do the full census once every 10 years. So they're not precise, but these are the best numbers that we have on a year-to-year basis. And it shows that we lost, a little bit shy of 2,000 people last year, which is, you know, worrisome for the state's economy. This is obviously, as you mentioned, our demographics don't favor us in this realm. We had a boost during the pandemic where we were getting some more people from other states. We've also been able to mitigate our poor demographics through international migration. Mm-hmm. And what we saw this year is that we had drops in all fronts. So more people are still dying in Vermont than are being born. We actually lost people to moving out of Vermont to other states last year. And then the number of people immigrating into Vermont from other countries was actually about half as many as it had been the previous year. That mirrors a national trend that is likely linked to changes in federal policies around refugee resettlement programs and deportations, things like that.
And again, you're saying Vermont led the nation in this decline.
In terms of a percent of our population, and there were only a handful of states in the first place that had declining populations. So we're very much an outlier in this realm. And you know, you can speculate about all of the reasons why this is the case. Certainly, I've heard many explanations from readers and listeners on that. But, people who are worried about Vermont's economy think we really need to be moving the needle and starting to grow our population in order to solve our tax base issues and our workforce issues.
This connects with the housing thing, too, right?
Absolutely. I mean, follow up to that. I mean, you hear a lot of conversation around needing to build more to be able to keep young people in Vermont, to be able to have homes for people who are interested in moving here for jobs, too.
Yeah, those are sobering numbers for sure. Derek Brower, let me stick with you here because there was a state policing panel that recently took a look at the issue of high-speed chases in Vermont. There have been some, really difficult stories connected to this. The panel voted to say they will not restrict high-speed chases. What's going on here?
Yeah. So this has been in the spotlight because we have had a number of fatal police chases in Vermont, most notably one in Rutland a few years ago in which a 19-year-old police trainee was killed. There have been people within law enforcement pushing to have more restrictive chase policies for years. I mean, it is known as one of the more dangerous maneuvers that a police officer can undergo, and it's dangerous.
It's true on a national level too.
Exactly. And it's dangerous to everybody, right? I mean, it's a risk to the officer, it's a risk to the suspect, and it's a risk to bystanders. There was an effort led at a state advisory panel. It's called the Law Enforcement Advisory Board. This was pushed by the former chair, Sean Burke, who is now the interim police chief in Burlington. And it kind of sat on the back burner for a year. The board actually had trouble even having enough people show up to its meetings to conduct business. But when I spoke with them late last year, they had indicated that they were planning to actually take this up, and they told the legislature they're planning to take this up this year. That's all the backstory for how in January they met and very quickly decided this actually is not something they want to pursue any longer. They told me is that police chiefs have different opinions on this, and each department has its own assessment of its needs. Rural versus urban areas, for instance, may not want a uniform policy that applies to both. And there are also different philosophies. There are some police chiefs who are more cautious about these types of pursuits, and there are others who think it sends the wrong message to suspects that if you flee us, we're not going to chase.
Okay. Thank you for the update on that story. I appreciate that. We're going to move on to another story now that has to do with some protests, and folks may be aware of these happening in Vermont. Vermont State Police arrested 11 people and cited two others on trespassing charges on Monday after the group declined to leave a Williston building that houses an Immigration and Customs Enforcement office. Here are two of the protesters speaking to an NBC5 reporter about why they chose to take the action.
The point of getting arrested is to increase the information out there about what ICE is doing.
I've never been arrested before, but I feel really compelled with what's happening now to do everything I can to speak out.
Austin Gaffney, this is just the latest instance of protests targeting the surveillance facility. We just heard from those who protested on Monday that their goal is to really raise awareness here. A lot of people expressed the fact that they would be back. What is the end goal here for advocates?
I think there's two goals here for advocates. The first goal is to bring attention to the presence of ICE in Vermont, and that's not only through detentions and deportations, but also just the presence of facilities that do things like host a national tip line or do digital surveillance here in Vermont. I would say the other thing they're trying to do is to end the leases or to have managers and owners of these buildings where the facilities are to cancel those leases. So far, managers and owners have said they don't intend to cancel these leases. They've been in the works for, in some cases, like 16 years. It's not a new thing for Vermont.
Yeah, I got to say, this is not even just a David and Goliath thing. It just seems like an effort that even the protesters themselves realize probably won't come to fruition. But when you see the visuals of some of those folks out there who, you know, many were elderly, some were walking with walkers and canes, willing to be arrested, I mean, I think that is sort of the image they want to have get out there, right?
Yeah, I think you've really seen a push among activists in Vermont to at least show their presence in their refusal to kind of fall in line with ICE and with federal policy around ICE. So we've seen that in marches, we've seen it in noise demonstrations, banner drops, and then these most recent arrests.
Yeah, and you know, it's really something because we have not seen the major surge in ICE presence here in Vermont yet, as we've seen in some other states, in Minnesota, mm-hmm. in Maine, but certainly the presence is there. And again, this is this data facility in Williston. They do data collecting, right?
Yeah, they do data collecting. We have seen, though, not the same surge that we've seen in like Maine and Massachusetts in terms of apprehensions, but there has been, according to Migrant Justice, which is a local advocacy group, a tenfold increase in the amount of people detained or apprehended in Vermont in 2025 as compared to 2024.
Wow, tenfold.
Yeah.
That's pretty striking. Well, that leads me to this next question about the Department of Corrections in Vermont has apparently been publishing immigrant detainee data. Mm-hmm. Where are they publishing this? Why are they publishing this?
So it's actually a very publicly accessible dashboard just on their webpage. They started publishing it last week. It is updated every Wednesday. Mm. And it's been in the works for about 6 months now. A reporter who was at VT Digger reported in July that it was due to a push from advocates who wanted to see more data transparency. Now advocates are saying they want to take that a step further. They want more from the state than just data transparency.
And this is what, to what end? Why do they want this information to be public?
Because so far there hasn't been publicly accessible information about how many people are detained in Vermont. So these aren't necessarily people who have been apprehended in the state of Vermont, but people who pass through Vermont's jail systems. The whole New England region is an area in which people detained by Customs and Immigration Enforcement groups are kind of like moved between different jails, but there's not a lot of like transparency around who moves where and when and why.
Interesting. Okay, from one vulnerable population of people to another, Carly Berlin, I have to ask about, you know, at the time we're talking here on today's show, temperatures in Vermont, it's been a very cold winter. They've gone up a bit, you know, 30 degrees feels like 60 after some of the cold stuff we were through earlier. But it's been a real issue, I would imagine, for Vermont's homeless population with some of those incredibly cold temperatures earlier. What are folks doing to prevent Vermonters basically from freezing to death?
So the state this winter has expanded this program to open extreme cold weather shelters around the state. These are triggered when temperatures are below zero or negative 10 in some cases. Yeah. It varies a little bit based on location. And because there's this really strict weather-dependent criteria to get state reimbursement. These shelters will open when they hit the criteria and then close again once it gets a little bit warmer. Hmm. I tagged along in Burlington as they popped up the shelter last month. And just I wanted to see what went into this huge undertaking. Yeah. And it is that. It's a huge undertaking. This is, you know, not surprisingly, the largest one of these shelters of the six in the state. Hmm. But it requires, you know, transforming a whole gymnasium into a shelter and getting food for, you know, 60, 70 people who are staying there when it opens and getting all of those blankets and cots and everything ready. And then outreach workers go and drive around the Burlington area late at night to get people to the shelter itself. So I tagged along on that shuttle ride as Sarah Russell with CVOEO was getting calls from strangers saying, hey, I see someone who's sleeping outside the Price Chopper on Shelburne Road. Come pick them up. And it's just a massive amount of work.
That's a striking image that you just said there. That ride-along must have been fascinating, but also very scary and kind of sobering. You said 60, maybe 70 people sometimes are put in these shelters?
Yeah, exactly. And the Burlington one per night, this obviously varies a lot around the state. The others in more, you know, rural areas, smaller towns, are more like 10, 20, 30 beds. But yes, the Burlington one is about 60, 70. That's how many people they've been seeing.
And it's an all-volunteer effort to find these folks who are out there?
It varies a bit. The Burlington one is really more professionalized. It's all professional staff who's working, you know, overtime hours to have this operation open. In other parts of the state, it is more volunteer driven.
And Vermont still has a serious homelessness problem, right? Last time we checked, second, I think, in the nation per capita.
Yeah, fourth last year. But, you know, holding really steady from this big spike in homelessness that we saw during the pandemic.
Okay. Thank you very much for that update. I appreciate that. And I hope folks can find places to stay warm. We have an update on a story about a purchase of Smuggler's Notch. The owners of Burke Mountain are buying Smuggler's Notch Resort for an undisclosed price. The companies announced this on Wednesday. Bear Den Partners will have the majority ownership interest in the Jeffersonville Ski Resort. And the Stritzler family, who have owned Smuggler's Notch for nearly 30 years, will continue to have a minority ownership stake. Bear Den Partners CEO John Schaefer said they don't have immediate plans for any major changes to Smuggler's Notch. So an update on that story there. I want to turn to you, Derek Brower, about a story about, we just had the Super Bowl, you know, happen, and lots of wagering on the Super Bowl, everything from the coin toss to, you know, how many yards the Patriots are not going to get in that game. but also, it turns out that a lot of Vermonters are now betting on more obscure sports, apparently. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this was one of the more interesting things that I found when I looked at the data for 2025 in the state sports wagering program. Now, this was the second year of the program, and so I guess I sort of had assumed we would see kind of a consistent gradual increase as more people, you know, learn of it and start to become more accustomed to the idea of sports betting. But what we saw actually is that the increase in the amount wagered last year was really not in the main sports like football and basketball, but rather we saw pretty notable increases in a number of smaller sports. Now, I called them obscure. My story had some people point out that table tennis is, in fact, globally one of the more popular sports.
That's because of the new movie with Timothy Chalamet doing the Marty Supreme thing.
Yeah. But,
yeah, go
well,
on.
Well, suffice it to say, it's probably not you know, a top five sport for Vermonters to watch at home on TV, but many months out of the year, it actually was one of the top five sports that Vermonters were wagering on, as well as a sport that I am less familiar in as well, which is e-basketball. You may not know, but you can also wager on various video games as well, including video game basketball. And so we're seeing millions wagered on those sports as well. Now, I thought this was intriguing for one other reason, which is that, you know, one of the signs of problem gambling can be a tendency to start wagering on sporting events that you don't care about or you know very little about.
Interesting.
So I thought it was striking that we saw the growth in the industry appear to be more directed toward some of these other types of sports rather than the sports with perhaps the largest fan following in Vermont.
Yeah, again, if you're going to bet, please do so responsibly. I know that's the message they're trying to get out there now that it's legal in Vermont, but it doesn't always translate.
Well, it's hard. I mean, if you mentioned the Super Bowl, I mean, you're just inundated with ads for promoting sports wagering. It's pretty inescapable if you're a fan these days.
Yeah, it pretty much is. Well, from obscure sports to sports that folks do want to watch on television, it's really been incredible for Vermont athletes at the Winter Olympics to this point. Ben Ogden took home the first U.S. medal for a man in the U.S. in cross-country skiing in the sprint. First time in 50 years that a U.S. male athlete has won a medal in this. And it's so full circle because the last one to do it was also a Vermonter, Bill Koch, who set that got a medal, a silver, just as Ben did back in 1976. We also have Ryan Cochran-Siegel picking up a silver in the Super G, and Paula Molson, who was a UVM standout skier and an NCAA champ. She won a bronze in the Alpine combined, which was really kind of shocking because a lot of people expected Michaela Schifrin to be on the podium there, and she was not. So really, congratulations to all those athletes. And I do want to make sure that I mentioned you should tune into the Sports Report, our new show that's all about sports in Vermont and beyond, on Monday, because we're going to feature the interview that we did with Ben Ogden as we talk to him about his incredible win. A wonderful young man who really put it all into focus about how important it was for him to have that win and have it come back to Bill Koch, who his family, by the way, has been very close with for years. They grew up skiing together. It's just a wonderful story. So on the Sports Report on Monday, we will have that interview with Ben Ogden. Hope you can tune in for that. That's all we have the time for today. Thank you so much to our panel, Carly Berlin from Vermont Public and VT Digger, Derek Bauer from Vermont Public, and Austin Gaffney from VT Digger. I'm Mitch Wortley. Very appreciate you watching so very much, and join us next Friday for Vermont This Week.